So up for our next speakers, Hannes van Rensburg and Anesu Shuru from Dynamo Analytics. Hannes is the Managing Director at Dynamo South Africa. He leads the technical development team in their actuarial and financial modeling software. He focuses on automating actuarial processes. He also serves as the HAF for a number of South African insurance companies. And Anesu joined Dynamo in 2015. He's a fellow of the Actuarial Society. He's also a certified enterprise risk actuary. And he is in the consulting, in Dynamo's consulting team, working for local and UK clients, operating in the capital, working on consulting on capital, reserving, IFRS 17, and pricing. And he also is also on the team working on the automation software. And that's what they will be talking to us about today. Thanks, Hannes. Thanks, Anesu.
Thanks, Sias. You can come read our obituaries as well one day. It's obviously great to be here and speak to you a bit today about what we're doing and our thinking and just thinking in general. I think we at Gyro in the UK we had a couple of years ago was the whole theme was about AI and automation, and is this going to be taking over the actuarial, you know, are we actually going to be out of a job soon? And I think we're trying to think, you know, how do we actually optimally use the tech whilst we still develop ourselves professionally and able to make judgment and to know when to listen to the computer and when to actually, you know, step in. So, yeah, so that's a bit of an overview. So there's no clicker, so do I have to say, is there a clicker?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, there's a clicker.
Yeah.
Cool, I'll have it. So a couple of years ago at the IAA, I spoke a bit about automated processes. And so I've just thought about automation of reserving, and I came up with what I thought would be a definition or a good definition of what we're trying to achieve with reserve automation. So I came up with one, Anesu came up with his definition, and then as a company, we've got a definition in our materials. But so in terms of, and I'll explain why we kind of moved to call it diagnostic-led reserving. So in terms of automation, automated reserving process that can run hands-free and shouts out the main points of interest based on a predefined set of rules and a range of methods employed. So that's kind of my definition.
So my definition is you've got a process that's focused on an upfront investment of kind of coming up with a reserving policy, sort of parameters and assumptions for your reserving process, and then you have a machine that actually churns all of that for you every say periodically every month, and then your starting point, your starting focus point isn't actually how do you clean the data, it's actually how do you, what areas should I actually deep dive? I've got a starting sort of set of results, and what area should I actually deep dive? And then just as Dynamo sort of coined its own sort of definition of diagnostic-led reserving, which is really a technology-enabled top-down reserving process that reduces risks, increases efficiency, and empowers sort of reserving teams to focus more on the important stuff, to focus more on adding value and creating more strategic contributions for organizations.
So, and I think just in terms of automation, why is it needed? The reality is the world is becoming more complex, and there's more complex modeling requirements. The deadlines for sharing of information around a business and for reporting information to external stakeholders are shortening. And technology and processing power available, so it is available to us now, and we need the expertise to keep up with that. So tech should really augment what we do. So just a brief overview of what we'll cover. So we'll just talk about the goals of reserving and the range of methods available. Anissa is going to talk a bit about what a traditional reserving process looks like and establishing. So talk a bit about the framework for automation within the reserving team and the reserving function. Talk a bit about the survey. So we sent out a survey. Thanks for everyone that contributed to that. And our internal research and development studies. I'll talk a bit about the diagnostic-led reserving approach. So if the computer says no, what do we do? You know, why does it flag certain things? And how do we set things up to get the information we need to then identify the areas we need to go and explore? And that includes the visualization dashboards and tools. Okay, so this is quite a busy slide. I'm not going to talk about all of it, but I think the main thing we need to remember is the goal of reserving is to produce a reliable estimate of ultimate claims liabilities as early as possible. Sometimes when we start out in our careers, we're very focused on the methods. So we'd be, okay, this Munich chain ladder looks cool, and we try and code it up in Excel, and we get tied down in the method and almost defending our method or getting very technical, but we lose sight that the goal is really not the method, it is the result. And we need to be good reserving is producing an early estimate. There's no point 5 years on saying, well, now we've had great, massive prior year development in our reserves. The method, at the time, the method looked fine. The method told us the results, and if I look back, the method still looked fine. But it's really understanding when that method is appropriate and adjusting that method to be a reliable predictor of future losses. So if we, and I mean, we all push for time, and consultants even more so, when you don't always have, you know, the process and the time to then come up with reserves, and we, you know, you look at your chain ladder paid and incurred. There's other methods we use, exposure-based methods. We love the BF, Munich chain ladder, if you're quite technical. There's average cost methods. Then there's actual Australian, there's a great presentation, if you go on the Actuaries UK site, from Anthony Clochton, about the Australian reserving methods that's focused on settlement numbers. So some of these methods, the PPCI, that's payment paid per claim incurred, would look at the average settlements in periods by development factor and project that, or payment and claims finalized. So we'd look at projection of finalizations of claims. And then PCE method is just looking at case estimates, actually projecting the open claims, not really the full incurred history. And all of those methods have certain strengths. And it doesn't mean that, like, we don't always look at all the methods, but we would set it up. Because if, for example, suddenly your incurred development is much higher or much lower, the paid per claim finalization could tell you, well, actually, there's more finalizations, or there's more incurred numbers, or, you know, that type of stuff. So we'll talk a bit about more about that. I just want to point out a few limitations of, you know, some of our most accepted methods. So, I mean, our paid chain ladders, it obviously assumes stability in settlement rates and amounts. It's very sensitive to portion developed, and obviously very volatile for immature years. And the risk today is that, you know, we're assuming that weighted past inflation will be projected forward. Now, we've obviously, in our working lifetime, we haven't really experienced a big inflation surge. Maybe in 2004 to 8, before the credit crunch, we saw some of that. But, you know, there was extended periods where inflation was 10, 15%. And we don't have that in our data. So we just need to think, is it time to actually look at our methods? Do we need to look at inflation-adjusted methods? That sort of thing. Incurred chain ladder, we assume that case estimates are reliable and stable. I mean, just at the moment, the clients we look at, there's a big backlog. Or they were, say, the first half of the year, in terms of how claims was processed. We had all the KZN floods. There was an over, surveyors couldn't stay ahead. So there was a lot of different delays in how the claims management process was followed. So the first estimates of loss would stay in there longer. So it's just, if you only rely on the incurred chain ladder, the chances are likely that you might have missed something. Yeah, and I guess BF, just point out, you know, prior assumptions. So the BF, it still relies on the percentage developed, but you're effectively assuming what's to come is what you expect. Now, if our business plans do not allow for inflation or our sudden underlying movements that we're not, that we haven't built into our prior assumptions, then obviously immediately your future component of your reserving is will definitely be out of whack. Just some more methods. So, ignoring triangle-based methods, there are individual claims methods that can very quickly run now, where a couple of years ago you needed a SAS expert to code some of these things up, or you needed really expensive GLM tools, but where now we've got Python, we've got things in our toolkit that we can use. There's stochastic methods. There's methods with names that's hard to pronounce. So there are loads of things we can do. I just want to check. So 3 or 4 years ago, I think it was maybe 3 or 4, maybe might have been 4, someone gave a talk about compartmentalized reserving. I can't remember who the speaker was, but it was a great presentation. I don't know if anyone was in there. Is there anyone that actually went and implemented compartmentalized reserving in their business? Anyone that uses it or have seen it being used? No? I thought that method, I thought it was great, but it's still, we haven't actually coded up. Anyone that's used the Berkowitz-Sherman? No? Okay. I wanted to give away a free entry to our Dynamo 5K, but I'll leave that. We'll do that for the survey. But yeah, I'm just interested because those methods are, I think the point I'm trying to make is there's lots of different methods that we can explore and can give us different diagnostics. Even if we don't use it, it will tell us something about our reserving. So let's just look at our current approach. So we will start with a chain ladder, and if it doesn't give us what we need, we might look at the other alternative chain ladder method, and then we go and smooth. So then we smooth that pattern. We take the data. If we've got 3 years of history, we'll smooth that. We might not even think of a tail factor. And we're very focused on that micro level. Is the pattern, is that correct? And then we're activating prior knowledge. We get our BF in. And I think there's a risk that we anchor to those techniques. Triangles provide a very, very summarized picture of the world. If you think about that, you might have thousands and thousands of claims that you summarize into a 5x5 annual triangle, or quarterly, or monthly, if you're very granular. And many times, our smoothing actually introduces bias. So, as an actuary, I see lots of savings in my property development pattern, with things settling, case estimates settling. But I would be at risk if I allow for all that. So I smooth that out. So, I'm now introducing a bias through. I wouldn't say fear, but I guess the point is that we need to actually allow for those savings, but to do that, we need to be comfortable or confident that those are likely to come out in the future. Just a couple of quotes before I hand over to Anesu. So I've just looked at some of the biggest failures in reserving in the news. So the top one there was Independent. It was a very big insurance company in the UK. The CEO was very kind of draconian, and he owned the case estimates. So when it became obvious that there was a gap, his case estimate level started to come down, and they were very kind of in their communications very keen that we're very good at our case estimation, better than the rest of the market, and I think the issue there is that even claims that weren't that were actually ready to go onto the system was being held back. Now, if you were using an incurred development method and the actuaries at the time got into massive legal battles because of this, I think what saved them was that there was fraud involved. But they were using the chain ladder. And pretty much what we need to know is, that, and this is just from the report, in any delay in capturing a claim has the dangerous side effect of distorting reserve calculations. Because the system is under-recording the known likely cost of current claims, will also tend to underestimate future claims cost. The other, kind of in my kind of working lifetime, was in the UK, the big under-reserving around 2008-09 was bodily injury. So in the financial crisis, the number of claimants in a car suddenly started going up. And what a thing that surprised them was injury inflation. Caught everyone off guard. One of the leading insurers had a £300 million reserve deterioration in a year. That's one of the items. So inflation. The other thing just to point out is in 2008, AIG, they insured credit instrument insured mortgage-backed securities. In one day, you know, they were downgraded and all the guarantees, everything came in. If you were using kind of probability of default rates based on the past 10 years without looking at, you know, the subprime mortgages suddenly in these instruments that was never there. Yeah. Not looking at the granularity. So, yeah, just something. And I added South African actuaries under smooth their chain ladder. I think I think where we spend our time, we need to be conscious that it's not necessarily the areas that's going to point us to the danger signs. Cool. Anesu.
All right. Just to lead up to our what are we defined sort of like a diagnostic-led reserving. So our working group came up with a summary of stuff that we see traditional reserving processes running with. So a lot of traditional reserving processes, which some of you would have handled, it's sort of like a top-down approach. So you start from the data, look at every single class. Try and get the data in an appropriate format. Try and get your triangles ready. And about the moment when you get to your triangles, you've spent 80% of the time that you actually have available to do any kind of analysis. And then you spend 20% of the time actually doing stuff that's valuable. And still at that point, you have to look at every single class because you're actually not sure what's going to come out. So these kinds of traditional reserving processes we found to be fragile and slow. So I don't know for some of you, but I've seen teams where it takes them 1 to 2 weeks to actually come up with an IBNR estimate. So and as well, because there's a lot of topical stuff that happens every year, people sort of apply kind of like a patching approach to their process to try and get it to produce certain results that's required for that period, and the processes become very fragile, and there's heavy reliance on actuarial resources. So, I mean, if you go on LinkedIn every week, there's a job ad for analysts, especially in this season of IFRS 17, where people are trying to put resources towards IFRS 17, so they need to fill up the IBNR calculation team as well. So it's a lot of ads going out to try and fill in these actuarial roles. And then where you don't have actuarial people in the market, you try and sort of outsource from consultancies. So that's sort of the approach that people are taking. And there's quite a lot of sunk time and cost investment to actually delivering this IBNR. So people are trying to spend a lot more time just trying to get their data right, just trying to get their triangles right. But the people in the boardrooms, that's not their main concern. That's not the value add that they're looking for. But that's where actuaries are actually spending a lot of their time. And there's very limited foresight. I don't know for people. I've been in part of a team on secondment where we had to deliver stuff through Excel and stuff like that. But then you actually get to the end of the process, and that's when you start seeing surprises in your results. That's when you start seeing, okay, this is not reconciling to what I had in the beginning. Okay, this IBNR is completely out of line with what it should be, or this is not really showing what we were seeing in the data in the beginning. And by that time, you've gone through like 90% of the time that you actually have to deliver on your reserves, and then you have to go back and actually start fiddling with stuff because you've only realized towards the end that there's actually issues in your data and your results. And actuaries are spending quite a disproportionate amount of time turning the handle. So a lot of people in here, quite bright people, spending their time copying and pasting numbers, like replacing links, trying to check, does this number tie up to that number? Instead of trying to actually spend time providing insights that's actually topical for the board and providing information that's actually a lot more valuable. Cool. So with the diagnostic-led reserving approach, as I said, it's a tech-enabled top-down process where you have an initial investment into coming up with a reserving policy. So from a governance perspective, it's actually quite key to have a reserving process which you can communicate to someone and they can replicate. So you have an investment into actually coming up with a reserving process that's rules-based, and then you have an initial setting of assumptions that you run through your process and get an automated result. So the second step would be having a full mechanical end-to-end system. So an end-to-end system that's able to bring your data through, run those preliminary reserving, so your reserving method and your assumptions, and then at the end of it, you've got like dashboards that populate automatically. So and those dashboards, there's actually quite a bit of investment that needs to go into actually setting up the dashboards, because you actually have to come up with an approach that's very specific to your process, where you're actually trying to flag diagnostics that indicate, okay, maybe I need to look at that method as well, or maybe I need to dive into that class, or maybe this class we thought it wasn't material before, but now it's actually material. So you have you have sort of reds, for example, red, amber, green flags that actually, based on some thresholds, so indicate to you to say, okay, you need to actually go and deep dive, and then at that point you then go and deep dive based on materiality. And then you're able to actually go and tweak your base assumptions. So whether it's your pattern assumptions, whether it's your priori assumptions that are going into your reserving method. So all in all, what it actually means is at the beginning of your process, you've got a reserving process that's set up. And then the initial thing is to run your process, get an initial, in an automated fashion, get an initial set of results, and more time is actually spent into deep diving into more topical issues that are relevant for the business. And just to, in terms of some of the benefits, so you have a lot more focus on storytelling. As I said, just you have a lot more of your junior actuaries actually spending time doing what they actually paid for to actually provide insight to boards. You kind of smooth out your peaks and troughs of working. I know there's people in teams who sort of like have a lot of peaks at the end of the month, and then you have troughs. But then, because maybe in between the quarter, you can actually just run your automated set of rules, and it produces your results. It actually starts to smooth out your working culture, and people get a lot more fulfillment. They actually feel like they're doing actuarial work. You're not going to work and cleaning data. You're not going to work and copying and pasting stuff. You're not unlinking and relinking stuff, but you're actually doing actuarial work, and people actually find time to do what they actually enjoy. And there's obviously trade-offs to the approach. So as I mentioned, there's a high upfront investment. So to actually automate the system and then also come up with relevant diagnostics for your business that will help inform you of where you actually have to deep dive. I mean, Anas is going to give you an example of what we've actually come up with. So you actually have a set of diagnostics that actually are relevant for your business. So you need time to actually invest to say, okay, what do I want to see? Do I want to see paid over outstandings? Do I want to see change in ultimates? Do I want to see whatever you want to see? You actually invest time into it, but it's an upfront cost, and it's a cost that you can control. So get an expert, or if you're in-house expert, set up time to actually get an automated process, get your diagnostics right, and then from then on, you know, you can control your costs further down the line, instead of being responsive and every time you actually have to bring in an expert to help you get out of your, sort of dig you out of your hole in the moment that you need it. And then there's obviously sort of, you remain under pragmatic pressure. So obviously you've got more focus on the material lines, but then if someone comes and asks you, okay, what about that light? And then you know it's stable. The machine is telling you it's stable, but then you obviously have to give a response. So you have to go in and do a bit of digging. But then I mean, if you have at least if you have an automated process, you know you've got assurance that, okay, I actually put in more focus on the ones that on the lines that are actually material. That even, I mean, that trade-off is quite okay, because you still should have a capability in your system to actually go and dive deeper into a specific class. And then in a highly automated environment, obviously there's very limited capability to tinker with results. So you're not able to actually, okay, adjust for this specific journal, or there's a large loss that just came in and you want to fix up your reserves for it. But at the same time, from a governance perspective, if you're the chief actuary, if you're the half, I mean, you also, just the fact that there's the analysts don't have the ability to sort of put in the plus 1,000 every now and then in every cell, and then you're not actually aware what actually happened in your process. So it's actually something that can be favorable for you as a reviewer. Yeah. So I mean, our sort of working group did a bit of research. Some of the stuff that we found was that there's actually a lot of literature out there of people actually approaching a kind of like a top-down approach to diagnostic to their reserving process, and you actually have to, as I mentioned, you actually have to have a tailored approach to how you approach it. So it's kind of an initial investment to have something that's actually tailored to the process that you're looking at, and there's a lot more thinking that's required to move away from a traditional reserving process, because there's a lot of buy-in that's required, because some people, they're comfortable already with coming from a top-down approach. So it's kind of like a thought leadership that's required to actually drive people towards accepting that kind of a top-down approach. There's kind of limited methods being used. I mean, Hannes has already spoken to it, because there's actually very limited time for people to actually focus on all the different methods. And obviously we discovered that we actually need to test this in practice. So we have had people we've partnered with where we've said, okay, let's actually look at your business. And we're coming with quite a bit of diagnostics that we're seeing, okay, these are actually very informative and can help people move between different methods and understand their business a lot better. This is an example of what kind of like a rules-based approach would be fitted into your reserving process. So, for example, if you wanted to, you could put it. I mean, a typical automated process would have kind of like a scripter that allows you to say, for example, if run a base run, and then if the percentage developed from my pattern is less than 30%, select IER between 30 and 70 BF, and then above 70 chain lat, or whatever kind of rule you want to apply. And then you have kind of like a scripter that actually automates the data through that scripter and produces results on some dashboard that you can actually view. And it opens up people for sort of AI, so people can actually come up with clever machine learning approaches to actually help pick between methods. Okay, that's right. So I just want to thank everyone who contributed to the survey. It was very, very insightful, very helpful. So this is some of the graphs that we pulled together. So we had people telling us how many triangles they had. You can see there's quite a few people with more than 20 triangles. And I mean, there's one with 100 triangles. So there's someone who's actually turning 100 triangles. Who's got 100 triangles that they're turning every month?
Who's got 100? Who's got 60?
Who's got 60?
DeAndre, you must have 100.
Who had like 30? Who had 30? 30 to 40?
30 in the room.
In the room.
I have
20. Ah, there. Yeah, it's quite unfortunate other people actually joining online, but there's someone who actually has 100 triangles. Who's got one? Who's got one triangle? Who's got one triangle?
Less than five.
Who's reserving? Who's reserving? Who's reserving? Feels like the reserving actuaries are online.
I've got a female t-shirt. Sorry, yeah. You're welcome to come and get one up soon. All right.
Yeah, but it's quite so you can actually see there's actually a lot of people we're having to handle quite a lot of triangles and having to churn this every month or every quarter. And then we asked, is Excel your primary reserving tool? You can see there's still quite a few people who are still using Excel as their primary tool, even though a lot of people have argued that it's actually not fit for purpose to actually have a robust actuarial process. And then is your interim reserving an automated roll forward? So what I mean is do you have a process in place where you can just run and get a starting set of results in the interim period without any intervention and detailed analysis. So a lot of people actually do a full analysis. So a lot of people are having to go into their spreadsheets, or software or whatever, and having to analyze their results every month or every quarter. And then after data update, can your reserving process produce updated reporting with no human intervention? I mean, this is a classical, there's a journal that's been posted or there's a claim that's been fed in and it needs to go in. Can you actually just run your process through and get your results based on your preliminary set of methods and assumptions that you had already placed? And about 69% of the people said they can't actually do it. So people are actually going, once there's an update, they actually have to go and dive deep into their process and actually try and get an updated result and actually taking them long again. Cool.
Great. So I think we're drawing a lot of inferences from the survey, but I guess that's the type of just some thoughts around that. So now you've got an automated process, and you're running. You can run a hands-free, call it process. Data comes in, you hit play, you get a set of results. So how would you want your dashboards, what do you want your dashboards to tell you, and you know to know where you need to focus your attention on? So I've kind of, my thinking is we've got kind of a couple of levels of dashboards. So the high level would be, we want summaries based on numbers to be signed off. So your kind of top-level dashboards should mean something to the person that you're communicating it to. Whether that's a change in an ultimate or a change in an IBNR or an actual as expected, that's the first thing that obviously people would need to see. It shouldn't be like the percent, like what's changed in my pattern, for example. I think it should be at a level that you can easily communicate to management, and it should highlight the first level of items to investigate. So in this case, just a kind of a mock example, we've got five or four methods. We can see where our selection fits in between the different methods. We can see our actual versus expected immediately. We've got a materiality threshold for each class defined, saying that for this size, if there's a material, if the AVIS is outside of this range, then we need to investigate. We kind of have automated kind of flags, red, amber, green, that's based on a materiality threshold that's predefined. We have data quality metrics that highlight certain limitations to the data, so you would know that, okay, the automated process for this might not be as credible. If there is a movement outside of your materiality, is it driven by a large claim? I mean, is there something specific that's in the data that could drive that? So that flags it automatically. And then there will be an indicator to say, okay, for reserve group two, look at your reserving. So just by setting up rules around that. One step deeper, we can then say, okay, the ultimate at reserve group level is that within range. You can go down within underwriting year level, within underwriting and reserve group level. So you can kind of pick how deep you want to go with your dashboards. But it's just the first high level cut, quick and easy to see. The second level is what I would say relates to summaries, which shows the drivers of the impact and the movement. So you've seen my Avis E was outside of my expectation. What drives that? So we use just Power BI for some of the dashboards, but you can then click in, double click through, and then it will show, okay, due to the actual movement is this portion is due to change in projection assumptions, this movement is due to prior period changes, etc., and there's other adjustments that's flowing through. And if it's other adjustments, then you would probably want to go and have a look at what those are. So they should tell, that dashboard level should tell you kind of, you know, main levers for movements. I think analysis of change is a good way of starting with that. To communicate that might require some education to a non-technical audience, but it should be reasonably self-explanatory. And then we like to, you know, split the movements between changes in data and exposure, projection assumptions or segmentation changes, and method changes. And then level three is kind of like then go into more technical detail. So allow you to drill down. If you had to communicate, be more technical in terms of we change the method because of, you know, these assumptions are invalidated. You know, so there's kind of that level down. That's more for yourself and your own team and your own analysis. Some of the warning, I would kind of say warning indicators here. So one thing that if you use, for example, an incurred chain ladder to set your ultimates, and you then plot other methods against those ultimates. So one thing that we saw when we did the bodily injury investigation in 2009 was something that looked like this. So an incurred is used to select your ultimate, and every more recent accident period cohort flares up. So suddenly it looks like your payment percentages are speeding up a hell of a lot. And in that, if you might expect that. You can talk to your claims team and they might say, yeah, payments have been speeding up. We are processing things quicker. But yeah, just by plotting the paid percentages on your incurred ultimate would give you something like that, that will at least show you something is going on. Another thing that's I think you should look at is if you're projecting with incurred, and even though if the incurred Avis E looks fine and your incurred looks within expectation, plot your average costs for incremental cohorts. If you suddenly see that my average cost per claim is reducing in an inflationary environment, then you could, you know, that immediately is a warning signal. Other things that, so just what I've plotted there is actual versus expected for all methods. So not only looking at the actual versus expected for the method that you use to set the reserve. So I've got here plots for notification, so number of reported claims, number of finalized claims, the paid Avis E, and case estimate movements. So if I suddenly see my incurred is much lower than expected, or case estimates move or reduce a lot more than I thought, immediately I can see, well, we've settled a lot more claims this quarter. So it starts, you know, it points you to the conversations that you can start having with your claims team. Yeah, so just quickly, but there's hundreds of other things you could think of, but these are just some of the useful items we've looked at.
Cool. And then from and obviously there's governance and culture considerations around having an automated or diagnostic-led reserving process. And one of the key things is can a head of actuarial function or chief actuary sign off on your reserve. So can your process actually produce something that can give them assurance? Can you provide assurance to the board as well? So your automated process, is it actually producing something that the half can actually, or the board can actually have confidence that someone didn't go and put a plus 1,000 somewhere, or someone didn't, or there's a plus 1,000 that's still hanging from last year that no one actually knows what's supposed to happen to it. And as well, there's kind of materiality thresholds that you need to agree on from a governance perspective that, okay, these are the thresholds that we can have for any deviation from what we would want in our reserving process. There's there's kind of stuff that you need flagged in your dashboards. For example, there's the always classes. So you've got classes that you know, okay, for this class, I know every quarter I have to actually look at this class because it's actually a very volatile class, and every quarter there's a different story for this class. So you need something that can show you which are your always classes. You need something that can show you the unexpected minors. So those classes where, you know, they're starting to come out, they're starting to become more material, and your process or your diagnostics need to flag this. There's a golden goose, that's killed. These are classes where, you know, you've become very comfortable. You've become very comfortable that they're stable. So you the chief actuary doesn't actually spend a lot of time on them. But then all of a sudden it's become there's something that's actually happened in the data, but then you've defaulted to not looking at it, and it's actually going to impact you very significantly. So you need that flagged on your dashboard to say, okay, this class that you never used to look at, you need to actually look at it. And then there's obviously financial versus technical level considerations in terms of materiality, because your CFOs, your finance team will have their own materiality thresholds and stuff they don't accept. And then from a technical perspective as well, actuaries will have their own sort of thresholds that they need to assess. And then obviously from a governance perspective, there's can your process extract an audit trail of what has happened through the process? At the end of everything that has happened, can you have a report that's extracted from your automated process that can actually tell you this person did that on that place, or on this class we've deviated from our standard reserving process for such reason? And then from a culture perspective, there's obviously buy-in that's required from stakeholders. I mean, one thing that I've had constant interaction with is, for example, you've got journals that need to sort of feed into your reserving process, but sometimes the journals don't come in a standard approach. So it's getting buy-in from the finance team, from your accounting system team, to say, okay, we actually need stuff in this format. You've got UMAs, you've got brokers that bring in data in a format that's not suitable for kind of an automated approach. So you need to have a lot of discussion with them and actually have the buy-in of all your stakeholders.
I think we're pretty much out of time. So I'll just, 1 minute, just run through some of our thinking. So just think, maybe just start thinking in a bit of a different way. So think rules-based, not link ratio-based. Or try and automate the data manipulation, segmentation, adjustment processes as much as possible. Use a platform that can allow for script or code-based selections, so automation of in your selection process. Allow for a wide number of methods, whether it's your standard method that you use for selecting, but have other methods that give you insight that's outside of necessarily your main selection method. Know the limitations, let the process run through, have diagnostics. And the last one, still apply judgment. We're not saying let the computer do the work. I think there's a lot of core actuarial judgment and skills required to set up. It's almost harder to upfront think through a process, to think through why, you know, think through assumptions, what it will mean for results, to do that upfront and document it. It's actually a very interesting very interesting process and rewarding. You know, investigate other methods. Investigate time to study, to read up on new methods, and actually think, is it relevant? And implement those methods. Be great. Next time, we'll give a case of wine to the guy that implemented the compartmentalized reserving method. We'll leave that for the survey. But yeah, thank you very much. I think we'd run out of time. So if you have questions, you can come talk to us over coffee, or I don't know, see us. You can go for it. Two questions. Okay.
So I'll kick off with the first one from our online attendees. Hannes and Aneshi, is your experience around regulators or audit teams if you've run a diagnostic-led reserving process?
I think one thing with I've kind of experienced through audits are they like it when you say, for example, select the BF for you know, I have a set of rules that actually say, for this year, I'm going to select this method, and for this year, so changes through that. So typical questions would be, why did you change your method this year compared to last year? I think if the framework that should support an automated reserving process should answer those questions. So it's not about, it's not necessarily about the automation. It's about having an automated process and being able to spend time on the areas that matter and actually document those and have exceptions and auditability in why you select things. I think with the current process, because we spend so much time in preparation and actually going through a process of smoothing, and you know, we smooth something, now our ultimates move. If we actually kept last time's pattern, we know, you know, the movement is not due to my changing my assumptions. So I think, personally, I think it becomes more transparent because you know what you change, you document your process up front, and you deal with it by exception. So I think that's in the short, but I'm sure there's other reasons as well.
One question there in the back.
Andre, we don't need to make it difficult.
Morning, guys. Thanks, Hannes. Thanks, Anishu. Good presentation. I'm a strong supporter of diagnostic-led reserving. One question. We're going to talk somewhere today, IFRS 17. Someone will say it in a coffee break. How much of the benefit we invest in there will help us with IFRS 17 and or regulatory reserving? Thanks.
Okay, we're dealing with other clients where they're starting to get in there. They are in a sort of like a BAU phase, and it's starting to become sort of the reality is hitting that in 1 month you need to do IBNR, you need to do UPR, you need to do SAM, you need to do IFRS 17. So it becomes very important to be able to run all these things very fast. I mean, I'm sure there's people who are sleeping at 10 p.m. during month ends. There's people who are sleeping midnight even. trying to push a valuation through. And now you have IFRS 17 to do. So if you've got a machine that can actually just run through your IBNR process, and hopefully you also have a machine that does your regulatory calculations, reporting, and IFRS 17, you actually can just, as soon as data becomes available, all those systems can be automated and run, and there's a couple of dashboards and flags that the chief actually can already start looking at and instructing the analyst, okay, can you go and do this? Can you go and do that? Instead of waiting for the last, you know, day of regulatory submission or group submission or whatever you have to actually churn your results. So this actually sets you up to actually remain with insight. So there's a couple of people that I know are going to start dropping maybe some insightful reporting in order to fulfill the requirements of being able to do SAM and IFRS 17, but you don't have to do away with it if you have an automated process that can take care of that.
Yeah, just one last question. If we take a look at the entire reserving process, so you spend a lot of time focusing on the triangles itself, but have you spent any time on grouping the data into homogeneous clusters per APN 401, and how would you go about to do that?
So you're talking about the...
Yeah, I can go. So I guess having a process that's automated gives you that time to do those investigations. Because for a lot of people, they've probably been running the past 10 years of reserving with the same groups, but they've never actually challenged. They've never had time to actually challenge to say, should we be going granular? Maybe at the beginning, there wasn't enough data and they had, say, 5 triangles. Mm-hmm. They've got enough data, but they just haven't enough time to actually split out and do an analysis. So an automated process will assist with that. And then there's kind of machine learning sort of approaches that can also be used within your clustering type approaches that can actually help you within your automated reserving to suggest whether you've got enough grouping or you need to actually split out your reserving a bit better to get more insight. So yeah.
I think what you can do is you can then add a different split or categorization or segmentation as another method within the process. So you can add it to your automation. You don't necessarily need to do away with how you used to do that. You can bring new things in and investigate it. and then test it, test the impact of moving and changes. So it's, yeah, I think the framework allows for that, but I would see that more as a pre-analysis and a, once you're comfortable, then, I mean, you change your process, you document it, and, you know, people know why.
Okay. Thanks, gentlemen. Yes, give them an applause. Thank you.